I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Dana Villa, the PACEJD Professor of Political Science at the University of Notre Dame. We're discussing his 2017 book, Teachers of the People, Political Education in Rousseau, Hegel, Tocqueville, and Mill, from the University of Chicago Press. Villa works on late modern political philosophy, particularly the work of Hannah Arendt. His books include Public Freedom from Princeton University Press, Socratic Citizenship from Princeton, and Arendt and Heidegger, The Fate of the Political, also from Princeton. And so, first of all, let me say thank you so much, Dana Villa, for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
It's very nice to be here, Jeff.
So, Dana, this is a great book. I loved reading it. It contains many insightful readings of important 19th century thinkers, and also penetrating criticisms of them. And you do very well in connecting these past thinkers to contemporary problems. And we'll talk about all of this. But first of all, let me just thank you for writing the book.
You're welcome.
I do that with everyone. I'm very, very grateful. So first of all, the first question is I ask everyone is what's the motivation? What was the motivation for writing the book? Why did you pick this topic and why these particular thinkers?
Well, I guess I should start by saying, I did the research and the writing of all of this. It was spread over several years, and it was all before the election, which kind of throws the book in a slightly different light. It's not like anything I say in the book I'd take back as the result of Trump's election, but I think it does sort of highlight the need for education, if not political education, in quite the sense that I use in the book. So that's, the motivation largely has been, there's a negative motivation and a positive motivation. The positive motivation is to recover a certain strand in the thinking of Rousseau, Hegel, Tocqueville, and Mill about the necessity of political education and to sort of say, well, this is something that's, central for all of them and for fairly obvious historical reasons, right before and after the French Revolution. The people, quote unquote, the people, come onto the political stage for the first time. And all of these theorists are, so to speak, Hegel's a bit of a question mark, but on their side, they're all sort of liberalizing and progressive in intent. Rousseau, to say he's progressive, I know that's a bit odd sounding, but nevertheless, they all want ordinary people to have some role, and for most of them want ordinary people to have an enhanced role in political participation and power. So then the question is how to bring them up to speed, as it were. And positively, what I like is that they are focused on this problem. Negatively, what I don't like is that they all tend, their better angels notwithstanding, to lapse into one form or another of what liberals call the tutorial state. And in that regard, I see them as all carrying on, even Mill, I see them as all sort of carrying on a kind of residual Platonism. They don't have contempt for ordinary people in quite the way that Plato has, the demos as beast. But they all think of the demos, the people, as, in need of some fairly strong leading strings. So that's, so the positive bit is trying to recover their concern about political education, and the negative bit is, highlighting what I'm calling the residual Platonism. And my sort of stance, I guess you could call classically liberal, in that I'm strongly anti-paternalist. And if anything gets, my dander up, it's those elements of paternalism that we find in all four of these theorists. And I think that, bringing it into the contemporary moment, at least theoretically, there's lots and lots of people in different varieties take a generally sort of paternalistic tone towards ordinary people and their participation in the political process. So even deliberative Democrats, want to set up these experiments in deliberation in which sort of people are sort of, okay, here's the information about the issue, here's how we're going to, and sort of very, very kind of artificial attempts to create the circumstances under which something like democratic deliberation can take place amongst ordinary people. That would be sort of on the liberal left side of things in theory. And then on the right side of things, there's all these people who like to talk about virtue, which you may or may not be surprised to hear is kind of a notion that I'm allergic to. As George Gateb famously once said, there's no such thing as the good life, only lives which are not bad. And that's a sentiment that I agree with. So I don't like people who either sort of have these, on the one hand, these are highly artificial ideas of we can set up a deliberative context if it has X, Y, and Z sort of parameters and structure, and that will work and sort of guide ordinary people to the right conclusions. Or on the other hand, people who want to say, well, what they first need is some sort of, you know, heavy-handed moral formation, whether it be sort of inculcation of civic virtue in schools and churches and associations or what have you. So that's it.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, because I wanted to back up to think about the notion of what you mean by political education in general. I mean, I think you helpfully laid out what I take to be the main two components here, which sort of are traced throughout the book, which is a sort of understanding of political education as a moral education, as the sort of fostering of virtue. And then on the other hand, politics as educating the people in their intellect or their cognitive capacities. Is that how you envision political education? And maybe you can say a little bit more about how this form of political education came on the stage in the 19th century.
Yeah, that's how I think that the theorists that I'm treating think of political education, you know, this sort of moralizing aspect, the inculcation of civic virtue combined with sort of a participatory dimension in most of them. And in Hegel and Mill, in particular, this sort of intellectual dimension of, you know, actually having teachers or, you know, you know, the learned professions, and in the case of Mill, the universal class, the, you know, trained bureaucrats in the case of Hegel. When I think of political education, right, I do think of it in a very distinctly anti-paternalistic way. I think it's hugely presumptuous for people to think, you know, and basically illiberal for people to think that they have the appropriate set of virtues that they are going to inculcate through some instrumentality or another on the pliant mass, the pliant plastic mass of the people. So whenever I hear people talking about civic education or talking about, you know, moralizing forms of education, making men moral, to cite a title from Robbie George, I don't necessarily do what Hermann Göring famously supposedly said about culture. I don't have a revolver to reach for, but I do become very, very skeptical. So if you want people, you know, how do people, ordinary people, you know, become politically educated? Well, they become politically educated by doing things like, you know, reading the newspaper, by doing things like, you know, following the news, by doing things like joining political organizations or community organizations. And they learn from each other and from other sources that they come in contact with. And that is to say that, you know, in the old days, you could receive a good part of your political education, let's say, from a union. As we all know, unions are on the ropes in America today. And one thing Tocqueville was right about is that, you know, when you don't have associations like that, you get privatism. And when you get things like Facebook and the internet, you get this siloing of opinion, and people don't learn. They're not reading newspapers anymore, and they're not encountering either some form of organized political education through some vehicle like a union, or, you know, they're also not learning from, you know, viewpoints other than their own, since Facebook is set up to, you know, filter your feed so you get things that you, you know, will like. And so this creates, you know, in certain respects, you know, just doing political education in what I hesitate to use the word natural, but sort of the natural way of doing it is not having somebody come and say, here's a course in moral or civic education I'd like you to take, or here's a book I'd like you to read, or here's a church I'd like you to attend, or any of those kinds of things, right? You know, brush up on your Aristotle, that kind of thing. It's just that many of the vehicles of ordinary, everyday political education in this society are not in very good shape. And by saying these things, these vehicles are not in very good shape, I'm not talking about these overtly pedagogical approaches to educating a target audience. I think a lot of what goes on today under the guise of political education is simply, you know, ideological organizations pounding their ideology and their slogans into their target audiences. And that's not political education. That's just ideological, you know, propagandizing.
Yeah. And I mean, that's part of my, how I wonder the way you set this up, because so if you want to leave political education more or less to civil society, I mean, I take it some of the worries from these 19th century figures.
I'd say leave it to individuals. And the most important thing, which comes in at both the beginning and the end of the book, is, you know, America has a real crisis in that, you know, at least since Reagan, faith in our public educational institutions is being undermined actively. Mm. And I think that, you know, what you want above all, what an enlightened populace means for these, going back to Rousseau, Hegel, and all of those guys, it meant a literate public. And if you look at literacy studies conducted by the U.S. government and other organizations, you find that we're not doing very well on the literacy front. So my main concern is not with, you know, the virtucrats and education and virtue or anything like that. I tend to think of that as part of the problem. What I'm much more concerned with is that, you know, we don't, as a country, as a nation, we don't seem to have any real commitment anymore to public education and to universal literacy. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we view people in this society not as citizens, but as simply, you know, raw material, which is, you know, various levels of employability. Some people in our society, you know, the upper middle class, they go to very good universities, are highly trained and skilled. Most people are sort of, you know, minimally well-trained. They're literate, but, you know, that's about it. And then there's this sort of huge mass on the bottom, which is, you know, potentially employable, potentially sort of falling off the employment spectrum, on the verge of becoming redundant, as the British would say. And, you know, the basic, here I'll revert to my sort of democratic socialist leanings, the basic sort of capitalistic market take on, you know, ordinary people is, you know, well, that's what they are. They're consumers and they're possible employees. And, you know, so long as you have a reservoir of enough potential capable employees, that's all you have to care about. How they get minimally literate is not really your concern, right? And of course, you can always get workers from other cultures where they have better schools, right? So if you compare a country like the United States to a country like Finland, the United States looks pretty bad in terms of its commitment to public education. And public education, just to finish up this particular bit, is, I think, the most important, crucial aspect of anything that we'd like to call, you know, political education today. If we're not going to be platonic about it, if we're not going to be condescending about it, if we're not going to be paternalistic about it, then what we have to do is recommit to public education and recommit to universal literacy and not view our fellow citizens as just, you know, so much raw material, which is either useful or disposable.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, in this way, I think really brings out nicely the way that you, I think both in the introduction and the conclusion, want to turn away from the kind of Platonic elitism of these 19th century figures, but also not lapse into a populism, which you're also critical of, right? Just leave it over to the unreconstructed masses to reject any kind of role of the elites in political society.
Right. Well, and also just the idea that, you know, this notion of the people are, you know, naturally good, which I guess is Rousseau's idea to some degree. And, you know, we have that in America and it's, you know, botched and bastardized Sarah Palin form, you know, the sort of the real America where virtue still resides and it just happens to have a white skin. It's populism today is, you know, not all populism has historically been bad, but populism today has been nationalist, xenophobic, and, you know, obviously sort of much more of a kind of know-nothing variety. It's highly anti-intellectual, and it's, you know, presumes the moral rectitude and just general, you know, correctness of this entity, you know, the people, again, quote unquote. The people is always a minority, of course, in these new populist movements. You know, it's the white ethnic, whatever it is, minority, depending upon which country you're talking about. It's not like, you know, if you sort of view the people as, you know, actually being authentically represented in the movements like contemporary populism, then you're going to have this technocratic reflex, which is to say, well, right, you know, the less they're involved, the better, right? Let the experts continue on doing what they're doing. Without these interruptions and without the sort of eruption of something like Trumpism and then, you know, amateur hour in the government. The point here, I think, is that one has to focus on the lack of education on the one hand, and also the lack of avenues for participation and access to genuine public spaces in contemporary American and Western democracy. And when ordinary people, and this is sort of an insight of Tocqueville, when ordinary people can't find access to, you know, public spaces of deliberation and decision, or when those spaces are structured in such a way that input is very highly constrained and marginalized, then they tend to fall back, you know, on themselves and become increasingly frustrated and angry at the quote-unquote elites that are ruling them. And without that experience and without that sort of, encountering of other opinions, they are become easy prey for, you know, populist demagogues. But that's the point. You need both education and avenues for participation if you're going to avoid this kind of know-nothing populism. And, you know, what many people see as a kind of legitimate resentment.
Okay. Yeah, I thought we could move on to the particular thinkers to see how some of these themes are manifest in them. So the chapter 2 is on Rousseau, and you bring out, I think, quite clearly the paradox that's in Rousseau, which finds itself in these other thinkers as well, which is, on the one hand, a commitment to a kind of democratic autonomy in this social contract, but on the other hand, we need some account as to how the people are constructed. And Rousseau turns to the figure of the great legislator, which puts him in this line with Plato and Machiavelli. I thought you maybe could talk a little bit about this figure of the great legislator in Rousseau and how it's a solution for Rousseau, but it leads to some problems on your view.
Yeah, I bring the great legislator up because I'm addressing, you know, what has come to be called by lots of people, including, I guess, Michael Sandel back in the starting with his book, the formative project of civic republicanism. The idea that in the civic republican tradition from, you know, people like Machiavelli and Harrington down through Rousseau and beyond, the French revolutionaries, I guess, one finds this idea that, you know, citizens aren't found, they're made. How are they made? Well, they're formed by institutions, laws, and practices of a certain sort, the kind that inculcates civic virtue, the kind that sort of makes sure that the newly formed citizen places the common good, right, and sort of universal values over his or her particular interests. Not that particular interests are completely effaced, but it's just that when they come in tension with each other, the good, properly formed citizen will lean towards the common good or universal values. Now, you know, Rousseau's version of it is quite like Machiavelli's, the great legislator who comes, you know, Solon, Lycurgus, Moses, you know, take your pick. These guys come along, they find a, you know, quote-unquote rude populace that hasn't been organized much, politically speaking, and they gift it with a set of institutions, laws, and customs which mold, form, this sort of dispersed and rude people into a political people capable of something like collective sovereignty. Okay. So it's that image of sort of picking up a kind of dispersed yet plastic mass of humanity, shaping it with institutions, laws, and customs into a political people, which will now have a collective will, or as we say, let's say, a moi commun, a general will, and be able to determine itself. The problem with this whole conception, of course, is, or twofold. On the one hand, you're viewing human beings as, to use this phrase I've already used, so much raw material to be shaped into a way that you think it ought to be shaped. And on the other hand, you've got this sort of odd, particularly in Rousseau, you know, it's just, you're trying to educate a people to autonomy, to self-government, but you can only do it the way you educate children to autonomy, which is to say, create a whole nest of sort of institutions, customs, laws, which will keep them very much on the straight and narrow path. You don't really want them to have too much liberty. In fact, in order for them, and this is something that thinkers in the liberal tradition have pointed out again and again, thinking of somebody like Isaiah Berlin, to be genuinely free, autonomous in Rousseau sense, means that you have to what? You have to sort of, very narrowly constrict that area of negative freedom that individuals have. And you do that through this regime of laws, institutions, and customs, and of course, in the social contract, Rousseau brings up the censorship. He thinks that that's something that should be brought back. And all of these institutions the Romans had to keep the population, quote unquote, moral and on the right track. So if you go from the social contract to something like Emile, it's sort of there, it's kind of illustrated, even more graphically for you, if you will, because Emile's tutor sort of brings him up. The whole idea is to have the child think that he's discovering these things for himself. But of course, every exercise has been carefully prepared and arranged by the tutor. So in both the case of the people and the great legislator, or Emile and his tutor, it's not as if either the people or Emile ever really slip out of the leading strings. They become autonomous in this kind of, sort of almost puppet-like way, because you have the parental, the parental presence of the great legislator or the tutor lurking in the background. And if those paternal presences weren't there, then either the rude young people or Emile would wander off and do things which are not in its best interest, at least from the point of view of the great legislator or Emile's tutor.
Yeah. I mean, I'm assuming a lot of what motivates Rousseau to come to some such extreme conclusions are his perhaps extreme views about human nature having to do with, say our amour propre and how we in society experience a kind of excessive form of dependence on one another. Mm-hmm. And the only way to achieve such independence is through this sort of Emile, allowing Emile to feel that he's independent when he's really in fact dependent behind the scenes, to just cloak the dependence, or to have a great legislator come along and sort of reshape. So it almost seems like an intellectual exercise to solve a problem that's rooted very deep in human nature.
Yeah, I think I disagree with you on this. I know you've written a lot, obviously, on the idea of autonomy and this sort of the paradoxes that surround it. I don't know that it's for Rousseau. I mean, Rousseau's vision of human beings is that we're not afflicted by original sin. We're not, nasty and brutish in the way that Hobbes seems to think we are in the state of nature. We're sort of, natural man is innocent, premoral, kind of brutish, but not brutal. And then things go wrong, as you say, when, you begin to get social intercourse and people begin to compare themselves to each other, and that sort of dependence grows up and takes the place of what was originally a natural independence. Now, you never get back to independence, the only thing you can do in the social contract, if you're talking politics, is universalize the dependence. So everyone's, you know, equally dependent upon everybody else. And that's how the social contract works. And out of that universal dependence, you get equality. It's no longer natural equality. It's this very artificial civic equality. Is that rooted in human nature? It's rooted in human nature, I think. It's very difficult to use, you know, as I try to point out in a chapter, Rousseau uses nature in at least two, probably many more senses. When he's talking about natural man, you know, in the so-called state of nature, he's talking about, you know, that sort of premoral, pre-linguistic, pre-social, quasi-brute, right, wandering around in the forests. And then when he's talking about, you know, and when it comes to sort of comparing us, social and political human beings, to that, there's this tremendous abyss. You know, there's no continuity between us and that independent, quasi-brutish figure wandering around by himself in the forest. And that's one of the things that I kind of like about Rousseau, is that, in a sense, he makes the appeal to human nature. You know, it's bracketed. It no longer has the most you can say about, you know, that brutish, you know, natural being is that he represents a kind of degree zero, but that's it. And so, you know, the one thing that Rousseau does do is that he transmutes the problem of evil into, you know, a social register. You know, where does all the bad stuff come from? Well, not from our nature, but rather from the way our social interactions are structured. And that is, you know, for many people, that's either a great insight, if you're, you know, people on the left tend to think in those terms, you know, yes, to be crude and vulgar about it, society is to blame, right, for these sorts of things. And if you're on the right and religious, you think, well, this is where it all goes wrong. Right? People lose a sense of, you know, the sinful quality of human nature. And Rousseau clearly wants to flush the sinful nature of human nature, you know, despite his growing up in Geneva and all that. He really wants to get rid of that reference, right? And so in that sense, how rooted is all of this in human nature? Well, it's rooted, one wants to say, rather in the nature of social existence. And that makes it, you know, less of a problem of human nature than a problem of society as such.
Yeah, yeah. No, that, I mean, that's helpful. I mean, certainly Rousseau wants to narrow in on this problem of dependence, as you say. And it... So it's not clear, I mean, maybe this is your point, that it's not clear that Rousseau has to go to a homogenous general will and a great legislator in order to overcome the problems of dependence in society. Is that your point, or is your point something like we don't have to worry as much about the problems of dependence in society?
Oh, well, no. So his way out of... You know, the bad dependence of Amar Prop is always comparing yourself to somebody above or below you and being envious or, you know, sort of condescending, depending on, you know, whether you're looking up or you're looking down. It's not getting rid of dependence. Again, you know, the society that he represents in the social contract, you know, you give up everything, right? You give up all your rights and liberties. Yeah. To the community, and that makes you everybody's equally dependent on the community, right? And no, you know, and therefore we are now all equal. So we've given up everything, right? But we're now all equal to one another, and in that sense,
which, you know, kind of universal, right?
Universalized dependence in order to make us equal, and he thinks that it's only through equality, which is kept on the straight and narrow through certain kinds of institutions and procedures, that you will get what? The body of people legislating and acting, right, as a body. So the laws come from everyone and apply to everyone. But they have to, that presumes that this sort of public spirit inculcated by the laws, inculcated by the institutions, is there. When it begins to, you know, fade away, then you get people pretending that, you know, the laws they are proposing are for the general good, when in fact they're for some partial or sectional interest, right? So it's not a question of, getting rid of dependence. It's creating the right kind of artificial universal dependence. and making sure that institutions, laws, and customs operate in such a way that people are aware of that dependence, right? That my existence and the community's existence are so intertwined that what happens to the community affects me very, very directly. It's when people think that, begin to lose that sort of sense of solidarity, which comes through such universal dependence, that the whole thing begins to fray, and you start getting the beginnings of sort of interest group politics of the kind that we have today. And this is why, you know, wrongly, in their attempt to sort of create and preserve civic virtue, the French revolutionaries actually made a law against all partial associations, right? Because they thought that that would, you know, sort of suck people away from the general will and from that sense of solidarity and sort of generalized dependence upon the nation as such.
I found interesting the part of your chapter when you talk about Rousseau's recommendations for Corsica and for Poland, because here Rousseau shifts away from his model of the great legislator, particularly in Poland, develops much more of an organic versus a mechanistic account of the emergence of the people, but still holds on to this very homogenous view of the general will. I was curious about your views about the Corsica and Poland at the end of the day. I mean, you think Rousseau's on stronger grounds in those work than in the Social Contract, or less strong ground?
Well, in the case of both the Corsicans and the Poles, Rousseau, this is not, despite that he's being asked to sort of come up with these constitutional recommendations, which of course aren't published, but in his lifetime, nevertheless, he's not really fulfilling the role of a great legislator. Because why? Because the people, in this case, the Corsicans and the Poles, both cases, you know, already exists, right? And when it comes to the Corsicans, you know, they're, you know, okay, they're not, you know, they're hardly natural man, but they are, you know, simple enough and pure enough in their customs, relatively speaking, compared to the rest of, you know, corrupt Europe, that Rousseau thinks that they can, okay, here's a sort of people in its youth that hasn't been corrupted yet, and maybe we can sort of hold, you know, sort of preserve that condition longer than, you know, it otherwise might be preserved. And, you know, in that way, you know, he thinks that it's, in the end, everyone and everything becomes corrupted. That's just the, you know, the nature of things for Rousseau. You know, time goes by, and it's not a process of progress. It's a process of decline and corruption. But nevertheless, you know, the Corsican people have a sense of themselves as a people. They're in their youth, and, you know, if you set things up correctly, you can sort of hold on to that youth, you know, as long as possible. The Poles have been around, you know, much longer. They have a lot more political experience, most of it bad. You know, they're constantly being invaded, but, you know, Rousseau is very averse to tampering with the constitution, the Polish constitution, which has made the Poles who they are, namely fierce fighters for their own independence, their own liberty. There's much he doesn't like about the Polish constitution. He issues many recommendations, but he basically, you know, says, keep the framework, because this is what has made you what you are. And if you're able to, you know, continue the fight and sort of fend off the Prussians and the Russians and the Austrians and everybody else, well, you know, maybe you'll finally get your, you know, sort of give your independence some firm foundations. And as we know, that did not happen. But in both cases, the Corsicans and the Poles, it's not like here's a sort of, here's just a sort of raw batch of human material to be shaped kind of any way you want, right? Which is sort of this figure, Platonic figure, you know, sort of the great legislator or the philosopher king as this kind of artist of character, you know, sort of picking up this sort of plastic mass and forming it into a particular beautiful and moral shape. No, the Poles and the Corsicans, you know, already have a shape, and therefore you have to sort of work with that and within the boundaries set by that. So in both these constitutional projects, Rousseau is taking a step back. And as I say, it's sort of like, you know, here he's not being Platonic. You know, he doesn't have those sort of artistic, architectonic pretensions. But he is trying to sort of preserve those aspects of, you know, what in the 19th century they call national character. It's not a category we're entirely comfortable with today, but he wants to preserve those aspects of the national character of the Corsicans and the Poles, which will what? Continue to distinguish these relatively simple people, right, from their corrupt modern European brethren. And that's the important point for Rousseau.
Yeah, so is it that Rousseau changes his views, you think, from the social contract to these, or is it that these are just different circumstances and the social contract he's talking about a kind of undifferentiated mass, whereas in this case, these cases he's talking about an already semi-coherent people?
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, it's the difference between pure theory and practice. And, you know, I cite Kant's, you know, more or less obvious sentences that, well, there has to be a middle term here. And we can, you know, Rousseau, who is often presented as this, you know, and often reads like he's this highly abstract theorist of, popular sovereignty and civic equality, who, if you take the social contract and apply it literally, you get things like the French Terror. Or my favorite story about Rousseau is that Castro evidently was carrying around a copy of the social contract in his knapsack up in the mountains before the revolution. And that sort of goes with this idea. Well, yeah, he's, you know, this is a, he lays down certain theoretical benchmarks and the people have to measure up to them. And if they don't, off with their heads or, you know, in front of a firing squad with them. And he's not like that at all. And this is a, you know, I think that's a total sort of mischaracterization and, of, you know, what his intent was. He's surprisingly, sensitive to the differentiations between, you know, peoples. He would never, for example, have recommended the French people, you know, have a popular revolution of the sort that they did. Why? Because they were the most corrupt people in Europe. Of course, the simple peasants are better than the really corrupt aristocrats, but nevertheless, corruption, you know, goes up and down the scale. That's one of the lessons of Al Malaprop. The reasons the Poles and the Corsicans aren't completely corrupt like that is, again, has to do with their relative youth in the case of the Corsicans. And in the case of the Poles, it has more to do with their customs and the fact that they sort of have already sealed themselves off from other cultures and nations by having these very strong, vivid national customs that keep them sort of inward turned. And so, you know, so it's not that he disparages or, you know, rejects the teaching of the social contract when he starts writing these later pieces. Rather, it's that he turns out to be surprisingly sensitive to, you know, in an almost Montesquieuian way, to the, you know, the forces of circumstance. And he realizes his, so to speak, pure theory can't apply directly to this particular set of circumstances, whether it be the Corsican case or the Polish case. And I think that if you were to ask him, you know, if he had lived long enough to see the French Revolution, you know, he would have been very, not very optimistic about its prospects, which is not the way we tend to think about him. We tend to think of him as being the patron saint of the Jacobins and as being the, you know, the person that led Robespierre to take the line that Robespierre did. But of course, you know, Rousseau, in my view, is nothing like that. I mean, you know, this is anachronism, pure and simple. And the idea that the French people, a corrupt people, could ever turn into a virtuous community, he would have seen. You know, that might have been Robespierre's fantasy, but it certainly wasn't Rousseau's fantasy.
So does that moderate the criticism of Rousseau as a kind of Platonist? I'm just wondering at the end of the day if, I mean, I'm thinking in terms of his, you know, the lasting significance of Rousseau and where he goes wrong and where he goes right. I mean, if one of the ways he goes wrong is as Platonist, but at least only a Platonist in theory, but not in practice. I'm just trying to think about how then we should think about that side ultimately of his theory.
Yeah, I think the Platonist side, i.e. the great legislator side or the vanguard party side or whatever you want to call it, that side is the one that we tend to be, you know, sort of most out there in terms of people's understanding of Rousseau and how we teach Rousseau and all of that. I would say that in a way, the Platonism sort of subsides, but the through line is a kind of paternalism. And the paternalism can take the strong Platonic great legislator form. You know, okay, we're going to bash you into shape, you rude raw people, into a political people, and then we're going to put you in the sort of straitjacket of a certain set of customs, laws, and institutions to make sure you stay moral. You move from that to sort of this, you know, then that's clearly directly and sort of brutally paternalistic, to a paternalism which is more indirect, but it's still there in the sense that, you know, Rousseau is approaching these populations, the Corsicans or the Poles, as, you know, well, you know, they are kind of children, and you kind of have to treat them the way you treat children. Namely, you know, you don't start from scratch here, but you want to, insofar as it's possible, to sort of create fences and things around them, so that they don't become corrupt, right? So they don't have, you know, they don't have liberty as liberals understand liberty, right? They're kept within their culture, their way of life. And you set things up institutionally and also economically, of course, you know, in this way that insofar as possible, these cultures, these nations will be, you know, self-sufficient. They won't have trading relations. They won't be cosmopolitan in any way, shape, or form. That way lies corruption. So the through line is this sort of paternalistic view of peoples in general. It changes when from the case when you're thinking about forming a people to begin with versus preserving an already established people from the corruption that is rampant in the modern world. And that's what he's doing. You know, the Corsicans are relatively more pure than the Poles are. But even the Poles, given their national culture, their institutions, their festivals, all of that stuff, even the Poles can be, you know, seen as less corrupt than everybody else surrounding them. And so that's why, you know, he takes these projects on, because it's not like he's working with, you know, totally corrupt material in either case. But neither is he working with material that hasn't already been formed in a fairly fundamental way. So yes, Plato kind of subsides a little bit, but the paternalism sort of viewing people as children, that goes throughout, I'd say.
So let's shift over to Hegel. Hegel you present as distinct from Rousseau in several ways, and you nicely bring out, I think, the contrast that's there, that for Hegel, political education is in large part about understanding and social integration, not about self-government or autonomy. And you talk about the philosophy of right and the philosophy of history in this chapter. It's very good, very excellent chapter. I love returning to Hegel on these points. So maybe you could say a bit about where you see this political education to understanding and social integration in the philosophy of right. I thought we could start there.
Yeah, I want to say something like, you know, I'm basically Hegelian so long as you don't saddle me with the rationalism, which is sort of like saying I'm not a Hegelian. But one of the things I appreciate and love about Hegel is that it's precisely the thing that Leo Strauss loathed about all these guys. Namely, he sort of gets rid of the category of nature. You know, nature simply is brutishness, and the whole point is to move on from there. And that's, you know, I, as somebody who is decidedly modern or post-Enlightenment in outlook, you know, I always find this appeal to nature as a kind of normative standard is, I have to say, it's simply ridiculous. But that said, you know, since Hegel brings us, you know, sort of Rousseau took half the step into history and, you know, Hegel kind of completes it. You know, there we are. And the point about, from Hegel's standpoint, who the child of the Enlightenment, who's critical of the Enlightenment, somebody who, as we all know, celebrated the anniversary of the French Revolution throughout his life, you know, saw, had no, you know, no desire to be associated with, you know, rising German nationalism, right? called Napoleon the great constitutional lawyer from Paris was totally on the side of the liberalizing tendencies of, you know, the French Revolutionary and then Napoleonic expansion into all of these, you know, ancien regime principalities, duchies, and, you know, funny little political entities that made up Germany in those days. And so from that standpoint, you know, what do we get? Well, what we get is Hegel as somebody who's trying to trace back, you know, throughout human history, human spirit sort of advancing from one sort of form of government, whether it's Oriental despotism or whether it's beautiful Greek freedom, you know, or Roman Republic and the Roman Empire, sort of tracing all the way, you know, through. And what he's collecting along the way in the philosophy of history is sort of these advances in kind of institutional, cultural, and political understanding. And what is the end of history? Well, the claim that I make in the book is the end of history is you know, a kind of liberal constitutional state. That's not, you know, recently more and more sort of Hegel scholars have taken this line. But as we all know, in the light of the, you know, First and then the Second World War, Hegel was often read as this sort of nationalistic, you know, Prussian state worshiper. And that's not really faithful at all to the text of the philosophy of right. He's a liberalizer, but he's a liberalizer who, you know, precisely because he's so suspicious of German nationalism, doesn't turn to the people to sort of, you know, take over the reins of government, but rather, yes, let's get rid of all the aristocrats and let's make sure that the king, the constitutional monarch, only dots the I's and crosses the T's. And where do you put your faith? You put your faith in a new university-educated, trained civil service or bureaucracy, right? Those are the people who will actually work for the interest of all, right? And then you also have your assembly of estates and all of that, the sort of backward-looking dimension of Hegel. But nevertheless, you know, he's there trying to sort of set up a modern state and then integrating these social groups, right, the estates, into the new framework of the modern constitutional state, but in such a way that, you know, any group, let alone some sort of bogus entity called the people, begins to take political power and political judgment upon itself. It's more that they have to learn, appreciate, come to understand just how far we, humanity, has come in terms of our political and social institutions. And why, in light of that progress, the constitutional state, the sort of liberal constitutional order, is such a great thing. And, you know, from the point of view of, you know, the first half of the 19th century, Hegel is, it's not a bad position to take. You know, it would be obviously absurd to say, well, yes, we have to think of, you know, a constitutional monarchy as the be-all and end-all, the end of history. But, you know, again, that's not, Hegel's not being a prophet. He's just sort of saying, this is where we've come up to, and we've come up to a point that is worth preserving. And, of course, the Prussian state at that point does not completely, by any stretch of the imagination, measure up to what is laid out in the philosophy of right. There is no written constitution, for example. And that's something that Hegel, you know, sort of blows both hot and cold on, but it's something that he sort of obviously leans towards. And, you know, also in terms of, you know, representation and assemblies and things like that, you know, these have yet to find institutional embodiment of the Prussia of this day. So it's not just sort of Hegel kind of sketching out what's on the ground, but he's sketching out something, you know, much in the way, you know, think of it like, you know, it's perhaps not a great example, but John Rawls's sort of relation to, you know, contemporary liberal democratic reality. You know, it's not here's a utopian blueprint, right? But neither is it, you know, I'm merely describing what's there. You know, it occupies that middle ground, which I think is sort of the right place for political theory to be, actually.
Right. Yeah, and the preface to the philosophy of right, he of course says on the one hand that owl of Minerva only flies at night, so philosophy can only sort of articulate the nature of a regime when it's come to its full fruition. But on the other hand, he has this line about the rational is the actual and the actual is the rational, which is much discussed. But what he's not talking about is that just any old set of institutions in any political community is legitimate or rational. It's the underlying structure that the empirical institutions may not themselves live up to, right? That so it is there is clearly some room in Hegel for some, you know, critique of existing institutions. That seems right to me.
It comes down to that distinction between actuality and what Hegel calls mere existence, Dasein. And, you know, actuality for Hegel is kind of, you know, well, that's the fully realized, you know, concretized idea. So it's sort of like the idea is taking an essence and, putting it in history, making it, you know, concrete, worldly, and all of that. So you can tell, you know, there's the actuality, right, of liberal democracy, and then there's what we got, right, the mere existence. And we can say, you know, if you want to be, it's hard to be, you know, it's hard to be particularly proud at the moment of being an American, but nevertheless, we can sort of say, well, we have, you know, there are certain fundamental things that we have and we're trying to preserve that are indeed part of the actuality of liberal democracy. And what we're trying to get beyond is, you know, some of the excrescences and perversions that have cropped up along the way. And Hegel would sort of see himself as, you know, right, in his day. And this wasn't just his view. A lot of people, you know, again, this is, you know, if you look at England at the time of Hegel's writing, and Hegel tells you this, you know, they're still selling offices. It's still a venal system, right? People are buying them for their sons. And, you know, that's not the way to do things. And Prussia was viewed, and this sounds very weird because we're, you know, we've inherited this whole sort of Prussian state vocabulary, thanks to, you know, the fallout from both world wars, that Prussia was viewed by many, you know, people at the time, commentators at the time, as indeed one of the most liberal and rational states around, right? Precisely because they didn't do things like sell offices, precisely because they were taking steps to sort of create university education and an educated civil service and all of these things, which are relatively late arrivals in both England and indeed in America. So, you know, there you have it.
I was curious about where Hegel goes wrong. So it strikes me that at least two things that you have worries about Hegel. One is the structure of the estates and the corporations, which in the civil society section and the ethical life really seems to be the moment where the bourgeois is transformed through education into the citizen. And you talk about the estates as backward looking. So I'm curious about that, if you want to expand on that. But the other, I think, concern that you have, you tell me if this is right, is about the passivity of the Hegelian citizen. That as you read Hegel, the citizen doesn't have much to do. The citizen has to understand and comprehend the rationality of the state, but doesn't have much to contribute to that. I'm wondering in part about that latter claim, how to square that with Hegel's general concern about the emergence of subjective freedom and autonomy in the rational state. If the citizen doesn't have too much to do and just obey, isn't this just a return to substantial freedom of the past?
Yeah, well, I don't think I think you're putting your finger on something there, because Hegel, like Tocqueville in certain respects, they're both social conservatives, right? Even though they have their progressive political moments. Hegel's a social conservative in that he thinks that, you know, you become who you are by identifying yourself with a certain role and career in life. You know, he doesn't think that, he thinks the way the Ancien Regime did these things, you're born into it, is wrong and evil. But he doesn't think you really have an actual existence until you do sort of take up, right, a place in society and then take up the duties and rights that are attached to that place. So whether it's being a lawyer or whether it's being a tradesman or whether it's being, you know, a bureaucrat or this, that, and the other thing, they all come with their particular set of, you know, duties and responsibilities. So Hegel is a social conservative in that two things. He does kind of have a my station and its duties ethical outlook, number one. And number two, like Tocqueville, he's very concerned about atomization and wants to privilege integration, social integration, above everything else. he's sensitive to, you know, the early capitalism because he, like Marx and even like Tocqueville, right? They see it as this dissolvent presence, new presence on the scene. And how are you going to hold things together, right, and maintain a certain minimal sense of social and political solidarity in the face of, you know, ever strengthening market society and ever increasing capitalist accumulation? It's a real problem. But Hegel's response to that is to say, well, you know, the way you do it is to hold on to estate membership and to hold on to this sort of my station and its duties kind of ethos. Why is that not completely like, you know, the substantial of earlier cultures? And how does he square the, you know, the fact that he thinks that subjective freedom, the freedom of the moderns, is such a great thing? Well, again, you know, it's not like you're born into any of these roles. And he thinks that, you know, this is something, you know, you have, he's very insistent. You have the right to marry who you want. You have the right to, you know, worship as you want. You have the right to choose the career that you want. You know, you have the right, you know, all these sort of traditional liberal constitutional values. What he doesn't give you is sort of the full set of political rights that any liberal constitutional democrat today would expect people to have. What you get, rather, is this representation through estates, through an assembly of estates. And that is part of this sort of, you know, it's Hegel's state is hierarchical, not in the sense that there's a ruler and that everybody is underneath him, but it's hierarchical in that it's meant to be organic and everything is supposed to have a place and it's all supposed to fit together. And because everything has its place and it all fits together, you then have, the average citizen has, a sense of the whole, right? And therefore has solidarity with the whole, right? Because I, as a, you know, as a tradesman, I sort of know my place in civil society, right? But I'm also part of a professional grouping, right? And an association, and then part of a larger estate, and that estate has political representation in terms of the, you know, the constitutional order, and that feeds into the upper reaches of government and all of that. And, you know, you sort of are able to see it. Yes, I have my own sphere of individual interests and my own individual freedom and my own individual wishes, but I'm part of these larger circles, right, which start with career and profession, family, and then sort of move out through civil society and then up through the state itself. And that's why, as you know, Hegel, you know, uses the term state in two very distinct senses. There's the political state, what we normally think of when we talk about the state. But then there's the state in this much more comprehensive sense, which includes civil society, which includes the family, which includes the whole sort of estate structure and all of that. So, you know, the conservative side, if you will, the sort of anti-populist side is more Hegel. You know, it's, he winds up having, you know, a kind of liberal idea of freedom of the individual, which is set within this much broader context of a social form of freedom, which has to do with this strange Hegelian formulation, that freedom is being able to see yourself in an other, right? And that means, you know, having enough sense of solidarity with your society and your fellow citizens that you don't view them simply as competitors in the marketplace, but rather you see yourselves as part of a common project, a common community. And that's why communitarians, you know, like Charles Taylor, both like Hegel and also like Tocqueville, because they're sort of on the same line as far as that goes.
Yeah, and this is in part what, I mean, I find this part of Hegel in a way somewhat attractive because, you know, typically the attempt from you know, some other communitarians is to say, look, we can find our civic participation in a democracy through non-commercial associations, and it's a commercial life and society that sort of distorts democratic self-government. I mean, one of the useful things about Hegel is to sort of bring them together. I mean, the capitalist presence in modern life is not going to be overcome or defeated through state regulation or through the associational life of individuals elsewhere. It strikes me that one of the things that Hegel foresaw is a way to sort of regulate capitalism through a kind of organic articulation of the presence of individuals within that system, right? So I guess in part, I mean, I tend to see a little bit more democratic potential in Hegel, maybe than you do, just in the sense that, I mean, I can imagine Hegel these days advocating for, you know, workers' participation in corporate, you know, boards and corporate governance, right, as a way to think about how we can find some sort of integration within the market.
Yeah,
I don't know if you think about that. Or
yeah, I agree to some extent. I mean, the great thing about Hegel, again, you know, it's sort of, with Hegel, you're constantly tacking back and forth between, at least I am, between the things I like and the things that I'm not so thrilled about. And I don't really
right.
have a comprehensive weighing up if it's 50-50 or something, some other sort of ratio. But nevertheless, one of the great things about him is that he's very conscious of the socially dissolvent and worrisome aspects of capitalism. Namely, it's creating this sort of lumpen proletariat that are completely not integrated. People who don't have any sense of, you know, for very good reasons, they don't have any sense of solidarity. And this is a problem, right? And if market trends continue and if capitalism continues to produce these, you know, sub-proletarian people, you're building your social and political structure on sand, as it were. And so he's very, you know, I was going, while you were talking, I was thinking, well, Hegel is kind of, you know, it's more like FDR, right? He wants the state, now the state in the political sense, to offset the spirit of civil society understood in the narrowly economistic market capitalist sense. You need to have the state offset civil society to make sure that the spirit of civil society, the spirit of the market, doesn't penetrate everywhere. And today, as we all know, you know, this privatization wave and this desire to privatize everything, including education, right? You know, you'll forgive the language, and you know, sort of the attitude is screw public education. Let's just give public dollars to as many private, you know, sort of educational organizations, religious organizations, et cetera, as we can. And that's better, right? It's better because precisely it's not public, right? And Hegel reminds us that the public is not simply a word of damnation. It's something to be, have solidarity with. And, you know, if you can't talk in a positive way about public things like public institutions and public education, right, and, you know, and public goods, then, you know, you've got a real problem. And the problem is that you're unable to think of yourself as indeed a member of, you know, and now I'm going to use the word community in a non-communitarian sense, as a member of a community, which is to say, you either think, you know, and I say this as a good liberal, you know, moral individualist type, you know, I have a sense that we're all in this together, right? You know, as America, as it's going down the tubes, we're all affected by that. There are many people who don't think that we're all in this together because their position in the society and their level of wealth makes them seemingly exempt from what happens to the rest of the society. So Hegel is useful to remind us of these things, the positive role that government can play in bringing the market, right, and the economic side to heel when it goes to excessive lengths in privatizing and marketizing everything, making everything into a commodity, including education. And he's able to do that, and that's a very helpful, and for us today, here and now, important lesson to, you know, glean from him.
So I thought we could shift over to Hegel, Hegel to Tocqueville, I should say. Tocqueville has a very well-known view about political education through participation in voluntary organizations and through local political associations such as the New England Townships. One of the most interesting things I think about your chapter on Tocqueville is the way that you draw out a tension in Tocqueville's thought between that kind of account and what he owes to Rousseau, particularly about, you could say, the preconditions for this kind of participatory education in the form of the mores and manners that are required to even become a free people in the first place, that Tocqueville's particularly worried about in the case of France, but finds in America a particular model, namely in American religion. So maybe you could say a little bit about your concerns there about Tocqueville, particularly about religion and say on these, the problematic inheritance that he gets from Rousseau.
Yeah, the problematic inheritance, I think it's summed up, you know, that phrase in Rousseau's chapter on types of laws. He says, you know, but the most important law of all, you know, is, you know, it's not civil, it's not political, it's not none of these things fundamental. It's rather the law written on the hearts of citizens, right? Which is to say, for Rousseau, at the end of the day, it's the manners and mores of the people that really, really matter. And it's not so much the legislative legalistic structure or even the institutions themselves. It's, you know, as people would say, sort of the moral character of the people themselves. That's the sort of ultimate foundation. Tocqueville clearly thinks that as well. And he thinks that, you know, the French, for a variety of reasons, not least of which was the anti-Christian, aspect of, you know, a certain set of French revolutionaries, the de-Christianizing dimension of the French Revolution. But, you know, he thinks that, Tocqueville thinks that, you know, religion is and must be, a central part of the moral character, the manners and mores of any people. And like most thinkers in the Western tradition, Tocqueville also believes that, you know, you cannot have a stable society of any kind, let alone a stable democratic society, unless it's on the basis of, you know, some sort of fundament of shared belief. And by that, he doesn't mean, you know, he looks at America, he realizes, well, there's all kinds, you know, so there's a profusion of sects, but that, you know, is fine because they're all Christian. And that means that however many differentiations you have, you know, we even have Catholics now, right? Nevertheless, everybody more or less subscribes to the most basic tenets of Christian morality. And you need something like that as your sort of shared ground if you're going to have a stable democracy. And that sort of conception is obviously very attractive to many people today, people who talk about the demoralization of society or who talk about the over-secularization of society or who just generally have, as Tocqueville does, a kind of, you know, it's not so much the content of what you believe or the, you know, the purity of your belief or anything like that. It's that he thinks that religion serves a very useful and necessary social function. And so in that regard, you know, somebody like David Brooks is, you know, right. He's Tocqueville-like, but he's Tocquevillian. It's not so much religion for religion's sake, so much as the role that religion plays in giving a kind of moral ballast to a society. And that's all the more important when you have democratic freedom. And that's why Tocqueville has these, you know, if he's to be free, he must believe, you know, that line in Democracy in America. Because if you don't believe and you have democratic freedom, then, you know, all bets are off and people become anarchic and subscribe to radical political ideologies and think that, you know, a particular political end justifies any and all means you might want to employ to achieve it. The Americans aren't like that. They're not radical. And the reason they're not radical, Tocqueville thinks, is because they have these fixed moral points provided by shared Christian belief. Now, what I don't like about it is just, you know, this is a, so to speak, a pre-pluralist view of things, right? It's sort of ridiculous to say American democracy stands or falls with you know, the prevalence of any one set of beliefs, no matter how watered down they might be. We live in a pluralist society. There are Muslims, there are Jews, there are Christians, there are agnostics, there are atheists, there are Hindus, there are, you know, you name it, we've got it, right? And more people don't identify in quite the way Tocqueville would like them with, you know, organized Christianity of any kind. And that means you have to sort of accept what Rawls calls the fact of pluralism and then think of ways of, you know, well, what is our stability founded on other than if it can't be something like shared belief? And, you know, I think Rawls and other liberal thinkers have done, you know, marvelous work in sort of providing things, ideas, concepts like the, you know, overlapping consensus, which shows you that when it comes to fundamental constitutional political institutions, it's possible for people from very different, you know, backgrounds, religious, cultural, philosophical, to endorse, right, support the same institutions, albeit from these very different, you know, comprehensive doctrinal backgrounds. For somebody like Tocqueville, that project, you know, the Rawlsian overlapping consensus project, wouldn't make a heck of a lot of sense. But that, I think, is one of the reasons why Tocqueville is not a very good theorist for America today. The last thing I'll say about Tocqueville, the other thing that I really don't like about him, is that he has the reputation of, you know, talking about the tyranny of the majority and sort of saying, you know, the tyranny of majority thought and feeling and conformism, you know, which is happening in America, one of the things he doesn't like about America. And, you know, you can come away from reading those pages and think, well, yeah, he really is John Stuart Millian when it comes to that question. But of course he isn't, because he's perfectly, you know, as the instance of religion underlines, he's perfectly willing to entertain the idea of a kind of social tyranny of manners and mores, right? So long as it's the manners and mores that he thinks lends stability to a democratic polity. And by that, I mean, he's quite, there's one instance I cite in Democracy in America where he sort of approvingly tells you about the time that, you know, a judge somewhere, you know, refused to take the testimony of a witness because the person did not believe in God and the immortality of the soul, right? And you compare those passages in Tocqueville to John Stuart Mill's, you know, palpable sense of scandal when he brings it up in On Liberty of how a judge in a particular place refused to hear the testimony of a witness because that person had no theological belief. And I think, you know, I'm very much on the side of John Stuart Mill on this, and I just want to point out, underline again, Tocqueville's very willing to entertain the idea of a certain kind of conformity, a certain kind of social tyranny of the majority on the issues of manners and mores and shared belief.
I'm wondering about this because one of the things that I worry about in contemporary American society is, I'm not alone in this, certainly, but the tremendous polarization in American public and private life. And I think it strikes me one of the dimensions of that has to do with religion. So you see a kind of, if you look at these Pew studies, right, a kind of hollowing out of the moderate religious affiliation, say the mainline Protestant affiliation, and a tremendous rise on the one hand of evangelical Protestantism, and on the other hand, this tremendous, well documented rise of the nuns, not N-U-N, but N-O-N-E-S, right? The people who are not affiliated with any kind of religious association. I mean, so what, one of the things, at least for some commentators, is to think about in previous eras in American life, the ways in which a kind of moderate religious belief did play some integrating role in American culture in a way that the sort of loss of that has generated tremendous amount of polarization and a tremendous amount of conflict. I don't know if you, what you think about that, or maybe the answer is, well, we need a new form of social integration. Look to Rawls, but what do you think?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say look to Rawls. I'm not a Rawlsian, but I just think that when it comes to this question of, you know, you can look at Tocqueville and say, here's a guy, his big idea is civil society, the associational realm, and that makes him a pluralist. And my point is, well, he's a pluralist when it comes to associations, but he's not a pluralist in the sense of, you know, Isaiah Berlin's moral pluralism. He's not willing to entertain the idea of a society in which there isn't a solid foundation of shared belief, right? Rawls is willing to entertain the possibility of, you know, what we have, which is the fact of pluralism, that there isn't shared belief. There are many different philosophical and religious doctrines out there that people subscribe to. But we still have, you know, knock on wood, a stable democracy. From a Tocquevillian standpoint, that's impossible. But, you know, nevertheless, it's there. So how do you explain it? And that's where the overlapping consensus idea comes into play. As for your point about, you know, the rise of evangelical Protestantism and, you know, and the rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, you know, you can see that as here are yet two more big symptoms of growing anomy and atomization. People who are either completely disaffiliated, the nuns, N-O-N-E-S's, and then the people who go for these more, you know, sort of, you know, high energy, whacked out versions of Protestantism in the, you know, in these mega churches and things like that. And, you know, well, possibly that's one way of looking at it. But I would, against what you're suggesting, that, you know, there is various commentators who have suggested, well, maybe this really did supply a ballast, sort of a moderating sort. Two things need to be said. First, the obvious thing is that, well, maybe, you know, the millennials and all these other people who are coming up are finding other sort of channels and organizational sites, associational sites, which will also sort of serve that moderating function. It's just that they won't necessarily be religious. And if that disturbs you, that means, well, you're sentimental about the place religion used to have in your society. Okay. And there are a lot of people who are sentimental about the place religion used to have in this society. And that leads to my other point. My other point, of course, is even if we grant the assumption, what you're sort of saying, many of the commentators pointing to the moderating influence of a certain type of religion, you know, before things started to fall apart, let us say, you know, after the 60s. The trouble with that is, of course, that, you know, with that religion came an awful lot of things which are not particularly, you know, appealing, like rampant and violent homophobia and, of course, rampant and often violent patriarchy. That was part of that religious consensus, right? And, you know, I'm not sorry to see that go at all. I mean, you know, it's, you know, it may have contributed to a certain kind of stability, but it's stability that comes at a price to, you know, over half the population. So
that's good. It's time's running short, unfortunately. So just quickly on Mill, because I still want to ask you about the election, 2016 election, which you alluded to at the beginning. So I want to get to that at the end. But it's quickly on Mill. So Mill, you have a chapter on Mill, and again, you trace out this perhaps surprising paternalism that exists in Mill, along with these other thinkers. Mill, especially, who's generally taken to be one of the great anti-paternalist thinkers, certainly in On Liberty, then in Considerations on Representative Government, has a suggestion that we should give multiple votes to the better educated and the wise. So how to square this contradiction? I mean, why is Mill being contradictory between On Liberty and Considerations? Why does he turn to that paternalism?
Well, it's actually in On Liberty, as you know, at the, you know, the first chapter where he says, you know, you should, you know, have as much negative liberty, negative freedom, freedom from interference as possible, and sort of all the important issues, you know, what do I want to do, who I want to marry, what I want to think, you know, how I want to express it, all of that stuff, so long as it doesn't harm, right, somebody else's vital interests in life. And then he says, you know, but this complete freedom of discussion, lifestyle, association, all the rest of it. Needless to say, this only applies to what he calls, you know, mankind in its maturity, right? And so long as you're in your nonage, so long as you're immature, whether it's a culture or a civilization, you know, then, well, there you need paternalism. So Mill, you know, one of the, you know, Mill, like most 19th century thinkers, the thing I like about him is that he occupies the terrain of history, not nature, capital N. But in Mill's case, right, he has a very sort of, you know, progressive, you know, quasi-Hegelian sense of, you know, we're moving from A through B through C, from the primitive to the more and more mature, right? And a lot of our time, history of humanity, has been spent as children who are in need, as he says, you know, a Charlemagne or an Akbar, if they're lucky enough to find them, somebody who will, you know, beat them into shape and, you know, be more civilized, right, at early stages. And none of us, you know, you want to say, well, okay, maybe if we're talking about, you know, the 10th or 11th century, he's right about that. But of course, you know, you move it into the 19th century, and the reason Mill catches so much flack today is because not only did he work for the East India Company his entire life, but those pages in On Liberty and elsewhere, you know, clearly lend themselves to, you know, post-colonial critique. Here's liberal paternalism saying, you know, yes, freedom of thought, expression, association, all of that stuff, except for, right, the immature people, for example, India, who need the guiding and benign hand of British administration. So it's very easy to sort of say, you know, Mill, not call him a hypocrite. That's not what the post-colonial critique does. They basically say it's no accident that somebody who sort of puts forward these liberal values is at the same time an ideologue of imperialism, or an upholder of imperialism. I disagree with that entirely, but, you know, there you have it. You can either think of liberalism as nothing but the Trojan horse for imperialism, or as morally equivalent to imperialism. I don't think that at all. But in the case of Mill, the paternalism, as you say, the paternalism and anti-paternalism strands are intertwined. On Liberty is the most classic anti-paternalist, right, tract, even though it has this paragraph in the first chapter about people who are not yet mature and who need a guiding hand. But then, you know, in his subsequent work, you know, Mill very much has this idea of what he calls the authority of the instructed. And what he's worried about, the society democratizes. You know, you have to realize, you know, and this was a shock to me, that, you know, there wasn't what we would call one man, one vote, or one person, one vote, in England, you know, without restriction, without any restriction, until 1948, right? And up through then, you know, as a series of sort of, and to you know, after the, you know, the reforms in the earlier part of the 19th century, which opened things up a little bit, but when Mill was, you know, in the parliament, you know, he was working for working class emancipation and getting the vote. But what he worried about, as they all did, was, well, the majority of people in our society are working class, and that means they're uneducated, they're illiterate, because England doesn't have a scheme of universal public education for everybody, right? And therefore, if you had straight democracy, which Mill wants, he wants democracy, but, you know, these people have no experience, they have no education, right? You know, what are they going to do? They're going to be, and this goes back to Plato, right? They're going to be easily led astray by, you know, various, you know, unscrupulous demagogues. So what he wants, right, is at least for the time being, more votes given not to the elite of society. He has contempt for the Conservative Party and for aristocrats and all the Tories, right? But to people, educated professionals, right? People sort of like himself, but also, in, you know, sort of larger than himself. People who have come up, gone to university, have some education, and therefore have a wider view of things than most, you know, sort of uneducated workers in factories do. Now, one can sort of see this as part and parcel of, you know, his, you know, sort of liberal hypocrisy. I don't think it's that. I think it's more that he, you know, is really trying to find a way for this new phenomena of an increasingly educated middle and upper middle class, you know, so long as we're not actually educating, right, in the way that we should as a working class, at least we can possibly sort of contrive things or structure things such that the greater experience and knowledge of this educated class has a bit more weight in elections. Otherwise, the educated class will be a minority without representation if you're deciding elections according to majority vote. And that's what he was worried about. People like himself would actually have no voice, and that they were the ones who needed, right, amplification and support as things began to democratize and elections became wider. So it is a problem. Mill does sort of straddle, you know, on the one hand, he's this great anti-paternalist, anti-Platonist. On the other hand, he winds up sort of saying, you know, having this, what I call a kind of trickle-down theory of sort of political experience and political knowledge. But, you know, to give him the benefit of the doubt, you know, he was working for equality of women. He was working to include workers in the public political sphere. He just worried about what happens when you know, you have this tremendous majority mass, which has been kept, right, for centuries in a state of illiteracy, and then you try to bring them into the public political sphere. And, you know, we would say, well, no problem. You just have a, you know, scheme of universal, you know, education for everybody, and hopefully it's a good one, and hopefully everybody becomes literate. That was, you know, from Mill's historical position, that would have seemed utopian, right? It would have been easier from Mill's historical position to go with this fairly complicated and to us sort of crazy scheme of proportional representation and people having, you know, different types of people having a different number of votes and tallying them up in this fairly complicated way.
Right. So this leads into my last question. So the 2016 election, I'm reading this book after the 2016 election. You're writing it before. question. So maybe we should be more Platonist and more paternalistic, given the outcome of the election. If maybe we had our thumbs on the scale, the wise, Mills suggested, that the outcome would have been different. But you suggested at the beginning you'd stand by your views. Did anything change for you with this after the 2016 election?
I think the 2016 election and Trump in particular, even though he was the beneficiary of one of the best educations money can buy, I guess, he did go to an Ivy League school. It just goes to show how unseriously we take education in this country. And even people, I grew up in a working class town. I think I grew up with people who, became or are or would have become Trump voters. My town was New Britain, Connecticut, was in advanced state of decay. Industry had left, and this was in the 70s. And there was nothing left. There was a lot of enemy. There was a lot of, drug use and all the rest of it. And there was a lot of resentment and, hatred of gay people, hatred of minorities, the usual working class things. Now, how do you deal with that? Well, not through Platonic philosopher kings or anything like that, and not through Catholic moral education, because we had that. I remember that. How do you deal with it? Well, you make your schools better. And one of the things that I distinctly remember, again, this is anecdotal, it's my personal experience, which counts for very little. But, the New Britain public school system was on the leading edge of the decline of public education in this country. All of us knew it. And I spent most of my, time in basically a holding pen. That doesn't mean public education is necessarily bad. It means what? That we have tremendous inequalities, that if you live in a town with good property values, right, schools are locally funded, you have great schools like Newton, Massachusetts, or, Nutrier in Wilmette in Illinois outside of Chicago, you can have fabulous public schools. It's just that there's no will to do it, and there's no willingness to make things more equal when it comes to funding good public schools. And the result is we have often terrible public schools. And we have many, many people out there who want to see the public school system fail. And I just think that, one of the things the election teaches us is that if we let things like the public education system fail, if we let things like newspapers go out of existence, right, if we let these various, sort of privatization trends continue, then the advent of Trump isn't going to be, the exception that proves the rule. It will become the rule, because people will be less and less literate and less informed.
Well, Dana Villa, thank you so much for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
That's been great, Jeff. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.